I mean, I have a very low opinion of the NCAA at this point because essentially I honestly don't know what they do. Like, again, what do you actually do here?
What'd you say your job is
right
here?
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Kristen Bry, and in for Steve Scafidi, Jake Curtis.
Hello, hello. Happy hump day, indeed. Jake Curtis, General Counsel at Institute for Reforming Government. First, you've been here plenty of times filling in for Bill. Hold on.
New guy.
We got to teach you how to turn your mic on. You're so used to sitting in the other chair where Jazz can turn your mic on for you. But now, full-time guest co-host sitting in the chair I'm usually in. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. This is a different perspective. Yeah,
I know. I saw you walked in and sit in the other chair. I was like, no, you can sit in the bigger.
Right. This is a big chair.
The second biggest chair. I'm now in the big chair where Steve usually sits.
Right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome. And so, I thought we'd start because, you know, you've been on many times. We've had Quentin Claibon on many times. It's been a while since CJ Safer was on. But we have people from Institute for Reforming Government. But I don't know if we've ever really talked about what you guys do. And so we kind of reference it like it's like people should just know what you are, what the organization is. So what does Institute for Reforming Government actually do?
Yeah. Well, good question, right?
Okay.
So now I need to define this. So I think you always have to have a kind of a guiding principle, a mission. I think when I first got to IRG, I gave it some thought as far as kind of what is that mission? And I knew what it was, right? It's focusing on kitchen table issues. And I'm like, okay, what does that actually mean? But as I've been at IRG now going on 3 years, right, I think that really does make sense. Because when you look at the issues that we focus on, obviously we're center-right, but with today's politics kind of being what they are, I think there is real value to organizations that actually focus on another new guy error. Turn your phone off. actually focus on like real issues that people care about. We do polling at IRG, and it's not, right, we're a C3. So we're not doing the polling to influence a campaign or to, you know, find some issues that really resonate with the voters to go after an opponent, which, I mean, that's fine. That's what political campaigns do. I mean, we specifically do polling because we want to know exactly what Wisconsinites care about. We did a recent report. Courtney Gustafson, really our outreach coordinator, she physically went around the state and she sat down with people and tried to understand. And these were specifically individuals. They had voted in the presidential election, but they kind of sat out gubernatorial races. And so that's a really basic question. Why would you do that? Right? Why would you show up for a presidential election? Yes, there's a lot of money spent. It's influential in the sense of kind of setting the direction of the country. But as we talk about at IRG, and this is why we care about federalism, for those that aren't familiar with that principle, right? It's the fact that we have a federal government, but then we have 50 kind of state units of government, and they share power, right? The federal government isn't always the entity that should be regulating or taxing in a specific area. That's a shared power. So that's what we call federalism. It's a founding principle. And that matters because on a lot of the issues that I know you and Steve talk about and others, that are in that policy world care about, it's really the states that drive solutions or should be driving solutions and not the federal government.
Wasn't that what originally like laboratories of democracy, as far as you take it back like 100 years, as far as policies that would start out on the state level and then bubble up sometimes to being federal policy? And like Wisconsin was a leader in that, especially like with like kindergarten, right?
Right. And that's a great point that it can go both directions, right? Exactly. You can have kind of the laboratories of democracy concept where, okay, we're going to kind of basically test a policy out at the states. And maybe if one solution rises to the top, maybe then that's something that can be addressed at the federal level. And then there can be other issues that just are, I mean, we've talked about in the past, immigration. That is largely, I mean, there's some roles for states, but largely a federal issue, like the Congress and the president need to figure that issue out. But they're shared powers. And so when you kind of look at it in those terms, going back to the report that I referenced, it is frustrating when individuals show up for a presidential race, but they don't show up for a gubernatorial race, because my point is really it's state government and frankly local governments mm-hmm. that impact your day-to-day life more than the federal government. I mean, if you think about the issues that are really pressing at the national level right now, right? We have foreign policy, right? Obviously, hugely important to our nation and kind of what direction we take with respect to, you know, Iran. I saw North Korea in the news again, right? Those are big issues. Not to minimize it, because it's almost like they're so significant. It's a national issue that Congress and the president need to address. How do we address, you know, Iran? As far as a day-to-day Wisconsinite, they care about affordability. They care about the state of education in schools. They care about housing costs. And I know we're going to reference this. Another report that IRG just put out obviously I'm biased. And I'm
biased too. That's the point of this show. Right. Is we talk about our perspectives.
Highlighting IRG work product. But honestly, I sat down. Mary Jane is our newest hire. MJ, she's a staffer. And right there, there are average staffers and there's some really good staffers. And we've gotten lucky because we have an amazing former staffer who's focusing on policy. And she put together her first report that is outstanding. I read it for the first time last night. I'm like, this is great. Because even for those of us, it's almost like if you're digesting the news every day, like it can actually really be overwhelming.
Oh, yeah.
Like if you're like, I don't know how you guys do it every day. When I fill in or come in as a guest, like the last 2 days, I've been like reading every Wall Street Journal I have. I've been going through WIS Politics. Because, okay, it's like, what are the major state issues? What are the major national issues? Is there any, like, interesting cultural issues going on? Like, it's really hard. And so when you look at something like a legislative session, right, we called a part-time legislature, and I think we've actually talked about this.
They're paid, but like full-time. But well, they work part-time. That's usually the criticism, right? It's because they gaveled out in April, and now they're all campaigning, but they get paid for a full year.
Well, now that's interesting because I've always thought Wisconsin really has the worst setup in the sense that they're part-time-ish. Because if you actually factor in like the number of like committee hearings and things like that they're attending, you really can't just look at the legislative calendar. You need to look at committee hearings. Like there's the summer where they study groups. Like when you add all of that in, it still isn't full-time, but it's like it's more than just part-time.
Yeah,
and they're paid like kind of part-time-ish. Like, I think it would be hard for, you know, for example, a family to...
I think some do, though.
Some do, well...
And that's why we're going to get to break, but that's what I think is interesting is that there's so many people... I think we're not at the most it ever was, but at one point, especially when there was a lot of, let's say, pro-landlord legislation passed, it was not, I would say, a coincidence that a lot of the people who were in the legislature were landlords, because that is a job when you own a lot of property. You don't have to, you can make money from that while also taking
my joke was landlords, real estate brokers, and bar owners.
Yeah, exactly. All right. He's Jay Curtis, General Counsel at Institute for Reforming Government. I am Kristen Bry. He is here for the full 2 hours. When we come back, we'll actually get a little bit into that Wisconsin legislative session recap and what the good, the bad, and the ugly was according to IRG. This is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is out until next Monday, and filling in for him today with me is Jake Curtis, General Counsel over at Institute for Reforming Government. Got a lot of fun topics to spar on today, potentially, or maybe find agreement on. But one of the things, as we were talking about, trying to define what Institute for Reforming Government does, I think in basic, it's a think tank, right? You guys do a lot of research, do polling to educate both the electorate and potentially policymakers on what's good for the state. And so you said Mary Jane Bem. Is that how you pronounce her last name? Beam? Bem? Mike? She did a wrap up of this last legislative session, and I read it last night as well. And I guess, it was kind of, these were the things that were accomplished. These were the things left on the table. I will say my favorite section, which, I say a little bit tongue in cheek, is the worst bills for freedom and prosperity.
Yeah. Let's go through them.
Let's go through those because I think that there's probably some stuff. So this was bills that didn't necessarily pass, but were introduced. Is that how it was defined? And that as IRG, labeling them as things that would be bad if they passed?
Yes, the only reason I'm hesitating is there might be some in the list that were vetoed, right? So that may have gotten through the legislative process, but then ultimately were vetoed. I'd have to look closely, but ultimately, yeah, these are bills that, well, I guess we break it down. There's multiple categories here, right? There's the bills that were passed in the legislature, like I said, or maybe didn't get a vote in the legislature, were vetoed, and then there were some proposals that. From the left that really didn't see the light of day, but I think it's important to highlight, like, okay, what are some of the other ideas?
Yeah.
And from our perspective, some of them are kind of problematic. And I think
so
those who
so
sponsor them
first,
need to defend them.
So I think the first one that's actually interesting, because I think there is this populist sentiment that is growing across the country. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about Graham Platner winning the primary in the next hour. We've seen the momentum that Francesca Hong has had here. You know, there's always going to be the Bernie Bros. And so there is a growing sentiment as far as billionaires paying their fair share, right? And so the first one under taxes and cost of living, did someone actually propose something as far as, because I know this is what Francesca Hong's running on, but having adding a fifth income tax bracket with the marginal tax rate for them, anyone making over $750,000 a year, be 17.7%, which would be one of, if not the highest tax bracket in the country?
Yeah, so that was AB 1209, and no, I don't have this memorized, but I have a great IRG report to cite to. Yeah, that would have created a fifth income tax bracket with a 17.7 rate for single filers earning $750 or more, or married couples earning $1 million or more. And so, yeah, it's that, in our opinion, would be a very bad idea. IRG, I think, has been one of the, I think, really primary proponents of actually eliminating the income tax, right? And even there's some disagreement on the right on this. Some of our friends have said, well, let's just you know, make it more competitive, maybe lower the rate. Flat tax, which Illinois has, right, is another option that's been on the table. And I think we have effectively at least made the argument, whether people agree or not, is that, look, if we really want to actually be competitive, you need to eliminate the income tax. And then maybe we require adjusting some of the other, right, kind of levers as far as sales tax. But the reality is we are just not going to be competitive when you look at Tennessee and Texas and Florida and New Hampshire and the state of Washington, right? So it's not just red states.
Or just warm states.
Right.
Right. Because I think there's always going to be it's never going to be apples and apples, apples to apples as far as where people want to live when you consider that our reputation is very cold.
Right.
And so there's going to be a handful of people, no matter what the income tax is here, that don't want to live here.
And it's, you know, you always see the argument, well, but then we're going to have to significantly increase the sales tax. But let's look at the spending, right? What's the purpose of the income tax, right? To fund government operations. We break down the Wisconsin state budget total spending. 15% increase this last session, up to $114 billion. So to put that in perspective, because they're just numbers, that's always the risk, you know, a think tank just to focus on numbers. It's like you need to relate it to people's lives. But I mean,
you tell a story.
But the story here is 2005, 2006. So, right, 20 years ago, two decades ago, the state budget was $54.3 billion. It is now $114 billion. And when you look at major areas of expenditures, public instruction is 37%. I mean, I think one of the key arguments that we don't have a lot of agreement right now, because I think you hear a lot from the left that we just need more K-12 funding, right? Quentin Claibon has done a significant amount of work. So we're already spending 37%, right? Of GPR, so that's the direct, right? It doesn't include federal grants, right? So that's just hard income tax dollars. 37% goes to public instruction, 26% to health services, 9% to shared revenue. So that's just going back to local units of government. 6% for corrections, 6% UW systems, and then 16% for everything else. So far and away, the largest line item for GPR spending in the state of Wisconsin is public instruction. Mm-hmm. And yet we're not getting better results. So this argument that we just need to spend more, right? The data does not back that up, right? Performance For K-12 students in Wisconsin have gone down.
So what do you
Population has gone down, either
you, Jake Curtis, or IRG as an organization, like, where do you put the solutions? Because I think that, to me, it becomes a both and, right? Like, I think there's also data that shows that our funding has not kept up with inflation once we decoupled those two things in the state of Wisconsin. I also agree. We have Kalestin on. I think he's actually on tomorrow, talking about, like, the archaic way that we fund schools, right? And that there we have a decrease in how many students there are and how many young people live here. And so having bigger thoughts as far as innovative ways to redistrict and think about how many kids are in each school, so administrative costs. So it is a both and conversation. And so let's take a break because we're running a little bit behind. But think about that a little bit as far as if the answer is not more money, what are some of the innovative solutions that could get scores up? Because I would say there's an argument to say if we think that education is the most important thing, maybe it should be the biggest line item in the state budget.
And it is.
And it is. All right. He is Jake Curtis. I am Kristen Bry. And this is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is out until Monday. Jake Curtis from Institute for Reform and Government is here with me all day. Any final thoughts in the last 30-ish seconds on the last legislative session or school, what we do with our schools?
Fixing schools in 30 seconds. Okay.
We can do it.
No, I mean, you need to, it's got to be all the above approach. You got to look at consolidation, right? That has to be on the table. And I know there's resistance to that because I think it was actually Chris Reeder who said, you know, everybody likes their Friday night lights. And I get that, right? You know, my kids play sports, right? There's kind of like the community element. Consolidation. We add a lot of non-teaching staff.
A lot.
Administration.
We should get rid of it.
What matters?
To be continued. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry here with Jake Curtis from Institute for Reforming Government all show long. And it's been a while since we had anyone on from Wisconsin Policy Forum, but we love the work that they do over there. And this one caught my eye. That came out in May. Small businesses, big stakes. And so Joe Pietrangelo, who is one of the research directors over there, looked at the state of small businesses in Wisconsin and what they're contributing to our economy and what the opportunities and challenges are. And so I wanted to talk to him a little bit more about what the report said and also what our policymakers can learn from it. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
So what was the inspiration to start looking at small businesses?
Well, so this report was commissioned by the Office of Business and Entrepreneurship at the Universities of Wisconsin. It was really meant to be sort of the first look. There hasn't really been a lot of research on the small business sector in the state. And so really just to understand and have a landscape report showing just critical information about small businesses, how many there are, how they've been changing over time, what sectors they're in, what challenges they're facing, and where there may be opportunities to strengthen small businesses in the state. So that was the intent. It wasn't as much to, we don't advocate as an organization, as you know, really just to understand what's happening with small businesses and where there may be opportunities to strengthen them.
So when we talk about this, because I feel like to me, small businesses, especially in the campaign politician world, small businesses, kids, veterans, there's usually kind of some buzzwords as far as who we're looking out for when we're campaigning for things. So when we're talking about small businesses in Wisconsin, what kind of companies are we actually talking about?
Well, we included all businesses with fewer than 500 employees based on the U.S. Small Business Administration's definition. We also, analyzed it, broke it down by the really micro businesses, the ones that have fewer than 10 employees, and then the ones with under 100, so we could see a different threshold. And then, so we examine it at the state level, at the metro area level, and at the industry level.
And so what did you find? I mean, what did we know about what the state of small businesses are in Wisconsin right now?
So, for example, we found that there has been faster growth in the number of small businesses since 2020. We found the state added about 20% more small businesses that met that definition. from 2020 to 2025, which was much faster than in the previous 5 years and the 5 years before that. So quite a bit of growth. A lot of that has been in those micro businesses, the really small ones with fewer than 10 employees. But we also found that a majority of the jobs in Wisconsin small businesses are in the more medium-sized businesses with between 10 and 99 employees. That's where a majority of the jobs are, and those are the businesses that have really driven most of the growth. One of the major findings of the report is that about 95% of Wisconsin's net job growth since 2010 has been on account of the small businesses that met our definition. Again, those with under 500 employees.
Repeat that, because that's a huge number. So 95% of job growth in Wisconsin since 2010 has been in small businesses.
Right. So we found that, you know, according to federal data, the state has added about 338,000 jobs, net jobs across the state, and 321,000 of those were in these small businesses, private establishments with fewer than 500 employees.
And what is there? Is there a dominant industry inside of that?
Yes. Healthcare has been the biggest driver of that. We found that about two-thirds of the state's net job growth, net small business job growth, came from small businesses in the healthcare sector. So that, and a majority of those jobs were due to new healthcare businesses as opposed to expansion of existing businesses. We've seen, like I said, quite a bit of activity of new businesses being created. One of the other key findings of our report, though, is that Wisconsin has lagged the nation in small business employment growth, and there could be multiple reasons for that, but that was one area that we found we were lagging the nation.
What does that mean? So what do you mean? How does that compare to how much growth we've seen, how much a percentage of growth we've seen in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so since 2010, Wisconsin has added small businesses at the same rate as the nation. So we've increased our number of small businesses by about 37%, same as the nation. But when it comes to job growth, Wisconsin lagged, and I'm trying to pull up these numbers for you, but let's see here. We specifically, so businesses with at least 100 employees in the state, we saw job growth of 12.9%. The nation saw a job growth of 23.6%. So pretty big difference there. We also lagged in the smaller categories, so stronger job growth nationally than in Wisconsin. Now, part of that is Wisconsin is an older state, and you know, we're not growing as fast our population. We still continue to have a low unemployment rate, so it's not necessarily catastrophic that we haven't grown as fast as the nation, but it is something to think about in terms of long-term growth in the state. Wisconsin, if we're going to continue to grow, we know that these small businesses drive job growth, and especially the ones that are able to grow beyond that first phase of being micro businesses, because those businesses with at least 10 employees are the ones that really drive job growth. We think that's one area that we could focus in helping businesses grow into that next level.
Morning, Joe. This is Jake Curtis from IRG. I thought the report was great. One question I had, and Chris and I were just talking about kind of the tax climate in Wisconsin. So I'm not a tax expert, but I guess I know enough that a lot of these small businesses, right, they might be kind of the pass-through S-corp where ultimately, right, the owner is paying kind of that personal income tax. Do you think that plays into that? Because I've seen similar numbers as far as, right, the actual job growth and I mean, maybe we're keeping track with the national average. I saw something where we're really not keeping up with our neighbors in the Midwest. Do you maybe think, and you know, full disclosure, IRG has talked about kind of the income tax and how we need to be more competitive. And when you look at small businesses, do you think that plays a part that, hey, you can start up a small business in a place like Tennessee and not have that personal income tax?
You know, that's not something we looked at or that came up in this report. We you know, in general, we did try to understand the trends and get at some of the reasons, but it's probably not as comprehensive, and that's something that we didn't discuss. When we interviewed small business leaders across the state for this and for in our previous research, we did hear a lot that small businesses struggle with access to capital, but also just being ready to attract capital. So a lot of small businesses not having necessarily the financial literacy, not having the business plans or, you know, everything in place in order to attract capital to grow to that next level. And so those are some of the barriers that we heard to growth, but it could be, you know, other factors as well. So I'm not saying that, you know, I can't really weigh in on that.
Just final question, Joe, on that, from what you heard from small businesses and like access to capital and financial literacy, what would be a policy solution to that problem or that obstacle?
Well, it could be increasing support for programs that provide technical assistance to small businesses, you know, really helping them prepare for growth, helping them develop a strong business plan that can support or can attract financing and help them go to that next level. It can be also planning, you know, how does the business scale? How do you scale employment, plan for, you know, staffing needs and all of that. So that's one area that there could be additional support. You know, workforce development strategies. We talk about, you know, Wisconsin's at a record high with apprenticeship participation, but, you know, we're also seeing a lot of the growth is in healthcare. We're also seeing that Wisconsin is lagging in certain high wage, knowledge intensive industries like professional scientific and technical services was one area we found Wisconsin's really lagging in. So really trying to strengthen the pipelines into some of those higher wage industries. So that can be through our university system, really like increasing the pipeline into those programs and strategies to really retain those professionals after they graduate.
Got it. All right. Well, the report is called Small Businesses, Big Stakes from Wisconsin Policy Forum. Joe Pietrangelo, thank you for your time today.
Thanks again.
All right. We'll be back with more after this. All right. We don't have a ton of time because we had a lot of time with Joe Pietrangelo from Wisconsin Policy Forum. But thank you for joining us. Again, that report is called Small Businesses, Big Stakes. But I guess it's interesting because I feel like we talk about the economy ahead of the governor's race. I don't know if we're talking about small businesses as much. I think Missy Hughes had a plan, one of her first plans as far as raising, like trying to get, you know, 50,000 more small businesses started. But what is your take on the governor's race? I guess we haven't really talked about it much because it's been a while since you've been here, Jake.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot to unpack there. So the roles are reversed. We had the Republicans had the contentious primary in 22. Now the shoe's on the other foot. Yeah. So Congressman Tiffany, I think technically he has a primary. I think somebody got some signatures in. But look, he's clearly going to have the support of, and this is where I think he's a strong candidate. He's going to have the support of the base, and I'll use the air quotes there. Mm-hmm. I think depending how the Democratic primary goes, right, there could be some independent support for Congressman Tiffany because at the end of the day, you want to talk about small business, right? The guy literally ran a dam and a tourist outfit up north, three daughters, I believe, who went through the public school system up there. I mean, he's just kind of like a normal Wisconsin guy, which I think is going to resonate, but also very sharp when it comes to policy. I personally met with him on numerous projects. He's, you know, call him a policy wonk, right? Is somebody actually serious about policy? He is. I mean, last time I was in D.C., Chris and I sat with the congressman himself and talked about administrative law for an hour. I don't know many congressmen that would do that. When he was in the state legislature, You know, agree with him or not, he was a leader on natural resource issues, which are very complicated. And you kind of have to have serious people in the room. And so I think all that being said, I think he's running a good campaign. And I think he is, I think, putting forward some serious proposals. And it's the Democratic field that is really, I think, in disarray. And I say that objectively because, you know, taking off my center right hat, just looking at the field, if you're a Dem voter, I don't know how you're really making heads or tails of any of these candidates, because you have what appears to me to be candidates trying to maybe run somewhat to the center, a little more, you know, maybe pro business, talking about small businesses just like we were. And then you have Representative Hong, who I mean she's a socialist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she calls herself
a socialist. She calls herself a socialist. And when you look at, you know, I know she's trying to clean up her statements when it came to the police following the George Floyd riots in 2020. I mean, she basically said, like, you know, we don't need police in society, which your average person knows that is just an incoherent statement. And so I think that field is really hard to figure out right now.
All right. Final question before we have to break for the top of the hour news. In your center right brain, for the policies that you care about and you want to see move forward, what is a better scenario if we end up having split government? A Democratic legislature and a Republican governor, or continue where we were and having a Democratic governor who's one of these candidates that we have right now, and Republicans hold on to the legislature?
I'm not sure you could have asked me a more difficult question, Kristen. I mean, seriously. Oh my gosh. The executive branch is really important,
okay,
because of the influence of the state agencies. I was at the DNR under Governor Walker. But at the end of the day, right, the legislature, and I think this goes, you know, we're in our 250th anniversary, right? When you look at the Federalist Papers and kind of the key thinkers during the founding era, right? The legislative branch is the branch that is the most direct to the people, that is the most representative of the people, and they hold the purse strings. So I guess the legislature, but I want a Republican governor.
I know what you want. Everyone probably knows what I want, but it was just an interesting question as far as if we continue split government, what is the more powerful position or branch of government to have? All right. He is Jake Curtis, general counselor over at Institute for Reforming Government. I am Kristen Bry. We'll be back with a whole other hour of more topics. Stay with us. News is next.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Kristen Bry, and in for Steve Scafidi, Jake Curtis.
Welcome to the second hour of Point Taken. Jake Curtis, general counsel over at Institute for Reforming Government, is still here for another hour. And I like how you phrased this. So we have to get into it. There was primaries last night. And I think no one really expected that the Graham Plattner momentum was going to stall ahead of the primary. He won by 50 points in his primary in Maine. But how you framed this on our outline for today was the Maine Senate debacle. And I find this topic, and the bigger topic being what behavior in a two-party system and the way our politics is set up becomes disqualifying for an elected official. And I think we're about to find out, especially in Maine. And so what are your takeaways so far from what we know about this guy and what it says about the state of our politics?
So I like how you framed that, because we'll get into the, I guess, specifics here of why this is such a big deal. But I guess taking a step back, I think there is a fundamental question of where is the line? I mean, as a Christian, I believe we are all flawed human beings that have the potential to do good things, but by default, that is not our state, meaning nobody is perfect. And so the question of where is that line, I think, is hard, because if the standard is only, you know, the most unblemished individuals can serve in office. I mean, right, that's not necessarily the right standard, right? There's stories of redemption, people who have, you know, made mistakes, maybe significant mistakes, but then changed their outlook on life and made improvements, right? And sometimes those type of people could be great representatives or great executives. But there is a line, and I guess in my mind, it's character matters, right? Their perspective on life. Again, as a Christian, kind of that servant, that humble servant leader mentality. That's kind of who we want serving. Individuals that are humble, can admit mistakes, can learn from mistakes. So again, the standard can't be, you know, perfect people because they don't exist. And that's why I think leading into the specifics here, what we see in Maine is just, you know, so everybody understands, it's one of the few seats that's potentially a pickup, right, for the left, which when you have...
It's almost like a mandatory. If there's any hope for Democrats to get a majority in the Senate, they have to win in Maine.
Correct. And so, again, this isn't really the interesting side of this, but just so everybody understands, well, why does it matter? The seat really matters. Like, if the Republicans protect Susan Collins and win that race, it's going to make it more difficult for the Dems to gain the majority. If the Dems win the majority, right, then the path is actually pretty clear. With a couple pickups, the Dems could be in the majority. So this race matters. Okay, so then who are the two candidates, right? The primary was last night. As you said, Plantner came out well ahead of now I think the specific there is the former governor, as I understand, or maybe the current governor. She essentially withdrew from the race.
Janet Mills withdrew from the race because she was basically getting crushed in the polls. And she's also 78. And yes, she's the current governor who was recruited by Chuck Schumer to win because she's an establishment Democrat. But yes, she was still on the ballot, but she has stopped actively campaigning.
So obviously Collins, maybe she had a primary, I don't even know, but she's the candidate for the Republicans. And so Graham Plantner wins. Here's a little background on Mr. Plantner. So first of all, he apparently has a Nazi tattoo on his chest, but not
well,
just,
now it's covered up, but
now it's covered up. And but to be clear, not just a swastika, like the SS tattoo, like
it was skull and crossbones.
Yes. Yeah. Specifically the representative of the SS. I mean, these are not good dudes. I mean, if you're going to get that type of tattoo, like that's going all in. And his explanation, he didn't know, doesn't make sense because a lot of people that actually know him and are familiar with his background said this guy's like actually a history buff. So not tracking. So you apparently have a Nazi sympathizer. He has logins for Predator's Paradise.
Which I don't know what that was. You told me that this morning. I was like, I've never heard of that one. I've heard of I read about the other one, the KIK. Yeah,
to be clear, it's because I read an article.
Okay. You don't also have an account?
No, okay. I do not. And KIK, which apparently is similar to Predator's Paradise. He made racist comments. He has made comments that all police are, I don't know if I can say this word, bastards. I've said it. So
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. I think you can. I think you're fine.
And clearly anti-Christian statements about the Virgin Mary. I mean, just for good measure, he has a DUI. So, you know, you look at this background and on any number of these metrics, probably not somebody that should be serving in the Senate. I mean, I think we can all agree, maybe not. But if we're going to talk about character, there's a lot of red flags here. And so, but as you kind of presented this topic, like the question is, if you're in Maine and you want to see a Democratic majority in the Senate, like, are you willing to vote for somebody like this? You know, the example you and I talked about is, because I'm sure people say, well, you know, the Republicans never do this. Actually, in 2017, Roy Moore, who turned out also is probably pre-Predator's Paradise, but
it was right before me too.
Yeah, and
really.
but he had some of those similar issues, and you know, to be clear,
no, I mean his issues were that he was actively as like there was credible sources as far as him dating minors, which is different than the accusations against Plantner of things that Plantner's also admitted to doing. Like
sure.
Roy Moore also was like kind of an actual predator.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this Plattner's, he's been sexting women after, you know, getting married.
Predators Paradise. This is a bigger question, because I think you have to know where I'm going to go with this as far as, did you or did you not vote for Donald Trump? And do we talk about his character and how many people who have voted for Donald Trump when he has cheated on all of his wives and has like credible accusations of sexual assault, including E. Jean Carroll, defrauded like a lot of different companies as far as how like filed for bankruptcy. Like there's a long list as far as how imperfect Donald Trump is. And yet people vote for him.
Right. No, I mean, look, okay. So a couple things. Let me finish the point about Roy Moore, right? Republicans did abandon him in 17. And a Democrat was elected from Alabama. As far as Trump, look, I supported Cruz in 16 and DeSantis in 24. So I think there are issues there that I think are problematic. And because I think character does count.
And I think we got to go to break, but I think character counts too. And this is my point as far as in a two-party system. Because you, in a primary, supported someone else because you had problems with Trump. But I'm guessing in the general, I can assume how you voted. And that is now the position that Maine voters are in, who want to see a Democrat in that seat, even if they have issues with his character. So let's keep the conversation going. He is Jake Curtis. I am Kristen Bry. And this is Point Taken.
So long, farewell. I'll be just saying adieu.
Adieu, adieu to you and you and you.
Okay, so welcome back. This is Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry talking to Jake Curtis from Institute for Reforming Government, and we are talking about Graham Plattner. Well, we're talking largely bigger about what position we put voters in when we have wildly imperfect candidates in a two-party system. Because this is my thing that I've brought up before to Steve, and we've brought it up to our listeners as far as you see a disapproval rating for President Trump. And there's pundits who want to pontificate as far as what that's going to mean for the midterms. But when push comes to shove, how much more, what is your line in this situation where you don't like the candidate, but you like the policies and you like the platform of the party? And do you not like that person so much that you would vote for the other party? And I don't think people switch that much, especially when it's wrapped up in your identity of like, and which we know in partisan polarized times, people more and more, like much more wrapped up in their identity of what their political ideology is.
Well, okay. There's a lot there and probably worth a whole nother segment. So yeah, I mean, first of all, people get like their identity should be faith, family, community, like as we talked about earlier, national politics really does not affect your day-to-day life as much as you think. State politics does in some ways, local government, but national politics not really. So stop, I guess, just obsessing about either side, right? Mm-hmm. Trump, Democrats in Congress, just focus on your local community. But anyway, one thing we talked about that I don't think gets enough attention is kind of the enthusiasm gap. So when you look at Trump's approval rating, I almost think that a mistake that the left can make is by just assuming, and actually I think it was the current state party chair for the Democratic Party made this point, I think it was last week, like don't assume just because President Trump's approval ratings are low that is going to necessarily result in success for the left in the fall, right? These are still ultimately local elections, right? State Senate, state assembly, these are just, right, largely driven by turnout in local communities,
yeah.
Right? But then I think there's a bigger question there of when you look at voter enthusiasm, like that is something to track because I think in response ultimately to your question here, does it mean a lot of Republicans are switching over and voting for Democrats? No, I think the risk right now for the right is they stay home. Mm-hmm. And that is right. We talked about that. That is if you are I know the political consultants, they're always looking 4 out of 4. 3 out of 4, right? The last 4-3 election cycles. Are you last 4 election cycles, are you voting every time? If you're a 4 out of 4 voter and you're not showing up, that is a direct impact on the election.
Yeah.
And so that's why when I look at a lot of these polls and favorability ratings, I often look at the enthusiasm, right? And usually it's framed in how likely are you to vote in this fall's election? When those numbers are low, 70-80%, which is low, right, versus the 90-95 that you probably see on the left. Like that gap, right, this is simple math even a lawyer can do, right, that 10% gap in a state like Wisconsin can have a very direct result on the elections. So that's what I would be looking at, is that enthusiasm gap.
In Maine, you think that the, you think there's a chance that the enthusiasm goes down because of Plattner's
baggage. I think it applies in Maine, where if you're somebody on the left that would otherwise be voting, right? Let's say you are a 4 out of 4 voter in Maine, and you just cannot get yourself to vote for Plattner, but you can't vote for Collins, and you just stay home, that's a direct impact on the election. Now, I would argue that the same is going to apply this fall here in Wisconsin. There are going to be some races. You look at the Derek Van Orten race that we were talking about off air. You look at that race in western Wisconsin. That's the one I would look at closely, right? If there's a significant drop off in the enthusiasm, that's just a 2-point, 3-point district. That's where it can be impacted. Probably doesn't impact any other district in the state, but that would be the one, the third congressional district to watch. Where are the approval numbers? But again, where's the enthusiasm gap?
Absolutely. All right. Well, I want to talk about a different race that is going to be probably close, maybe not close, but has already introduced AI into their advertising. We're talking about Texas and James Talafrico, as he has now embraced that term. So we'll talk about that on the other side of this.
Doe, a deer, a female deer, Ray, a drop of golden sun.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry here with Jake Curtis from Institute for Reforming Government. And as of yesterday, a new ad in the contentious Texas Senate race now features a AI-generated James Talarico, who's the Democratic candidate, singing a song about trans kids. So I know we have the video. So for people who are watching the YouTube, you'll be able to see the video. But at least if you're just listening, you can hear the audio. This is AI. This is not an actual video of James Talarico. But let's play it, Jazz.
Boys in white dresses with blue satin sashes, girls dust with hormones till they grow mustaches, changing the gender of all your offspring. These are a few of my favorite things.
So, Jake, how do you feel about AI entering our political ad landscape after it's already been such a hellscape?
Yeah, I think it's a problem. I think it's a significant problem.
Because this was not, we should say, it was not demarcated at all as being AI.
Yeah, and I when I first saw that, my first reaction was there's a simple solution, right? I think the First Amendment is significant when it comes to political speech. You know, look at Citizens United, right? That's based on the ability to spend money, influence elections, and that's ultimately, that is, I think, one of our most cherished rights, right? The First Amendment right to impact elections. That being said, right, there's probably some regulations when you look at disclaimers paid for by. We already require it paid for by. I think in Wisconsin, it used to have to list not only paid for by, you know, the committee to elect so-and-so, and then we'd even put like comma and then list the treasurer, you know, Joe Smith treasurer. My mind immediately went to why we should just require disclaimers that, you know, AI generated. I guess I don't know why we wouldn't consider something like that, because I think, and I listened or watched the video that you sent along where there was some commentary, and I think the commentator made some good points in that there's a real risk when you get, and the AI is advancing to such a degree that it's hard to distinguish between what is actually real, because we're still kind of in that phase. You can kind of tell something's AI generated. Like there's just something like a little off. Although
I fell for one the other day, and this was like so inconsequential, but there was an AI video of like a blow up lazy river that you could get from Costco. Like one big inflatable loop you could put in your backyard, and I sent it to someone. They're like, you know, this is AI, this isn't real. I was like, I don't know, it's Costco, maybe you could get that real thing. But then I think there was one the other day of Caitlin Clark and her like walking around and like looking very curvy, and someone like in a community note was like, this is AI. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely misleading. It's definitely like we need legislatures to act to actually, or our federal government to act to actually have these in place. But it's also, I mean, is it just all, like, as long as it's legal, it's fair game?
Well, this is why I think this is such a tough subject, because I absolutely would take the position that, we do not want the government regulating, the actual content of political speech, right? That's a very slippery slope.
Yeah.
But I think,
is this speech or this is advertising? I don't know. We got 5 seconds to the break.
Well, there's also the issue of, is it satire?
Yeah. All right. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry here with Jake Curtis for another half hour for the rest of the show. You brought this to my attention, which I think is super interesting because I'm interested to see where we have agreement on what to do about this. Because I love sports. I played basketball in high school. My dad played basketball for the Badgers. Big sports family. I hope my kid's an athlete. Your kids are athletes. And high school spring sports, done? Is there anything left? Is there any state tournaments left?
I think baseball is still going. I saw a couple little clips
about soccer.
That's a good question. So I can say definitively, track is over. State tournament was last weekend in lacrosse. You had some great performances from area schools. The Arrowhead girls, I believe, won the D1 title. I'm sure people are sick of, me talking about Kettle Moraine Lutheran, but sorry, I have the microphone. Kettle Moraine Lutheran, runner-up in D2 for girls track. So some great performances. I think baseball is still going on. Wisconsin Lutheran College, Wisconsin Lutheran High School has a great team. So, gosh, stop talking about the Lutherans. I'm sure all the texts are coming in. And I think what prompted this topic was we love sports. It brings us together.
Good character builder.
It's a great character builder. Whether you're a starter or the last guy or girl on the team. That's when I look back on my high school career at Wisco, being the very average, scrappy, athlete, I feel like helped me as I progressed and, went to law school and things like that.
There's studies showing this, especially for women, right? Like women who play D1 or like college sports and their success rate of like being on boards, being CEOs, being in the executive suite. Like there's like direct correlation for participation in athletics and how that correlates to careers and resiliency.
And then you look at the college landscape, and I think the statistic I heard was there's I think 500,000 athletes if you combine all the sports that are benefiting from scholarships, many of whom may have come from backgrounds or families where they would not have had that opportunity. We love high school sports, we love college sports, and what really caught my attention was there's actually a bipartisan bill right now in Congress. Senators Cruz, for obviously Republican from Texas, Cantwell, Democrat from Washington State, and then Coons and Schmidt, so Republican and Democrat there, have come out with a bill to basically save college sports. I was listening to a podcast over the weekend, and I always knew it was an issue, right? NIL is a huge development in the college landscape. But I guess I didn't really realize the impact on the, and I'm using air quotes here, the Olympic sports. Basically, anything other than football, basketball, maybe hockey, maybe baseball. But in reality, football and basketball, right? Those are the two revenue generators in major college athletic departments. And the problem is there's so many resources going to those programs. And so many of these boosters are setting up these insane funds. I mean, we're talking tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. Former Alabama coach Nick Saban actually testified on this at the Senate hearing. I believe it was last week. The problem is you're seeing essentially the budgets for these other programs just dry up. I think I sent you the article, the tennis program at Arkansas. So, it's a SEC program, a big program, probably not a top-tier
revenue
sport.
Generator.
It's probably, the dirty little secret is, right, most of the, your football program, maybe part of your basketball program, are largely funding the other. I mean, they're actually drains, which sounds bad.
Well, that
was
the whole argument from Chris McIntosh before he left being AD at University of Wisconsin to try to get the state budget, like the money for NIL, mostly going to UW-Madison, a little bit going to, I think, to Green Bay and Milwaukee. And obviously, a lot of people are like, didn't like that Governor Evers signed that, but that is the argument, right? It's like, if we're going to continue to fund some of these other sports where we see how many Badger women were on the women's U.S. hockey team in the Olympics right now, but like all these other sports that are great sports, but not revenue generators, like how do we keep those programs going when all the money is getting sucked up to try to pay players to attract the best players so that we can have a competitive football team?
Right. Well, and that's the point. And the problem is, I mean, look, I love football. I love basketball. But there's also, you know, my daughter runs cross country and track and have, you know, there's a couple D1 athletes on her team. And like, I hope they go on to do some amazing things in college. The problem is in 3, 4, 5 years, I mean, you listen to this testimony, there's a lot of people who are very knowledgeable on the subject who think most of these sports will not exist in 4 to 5 years. So that's removing a ton of opportunities for these kids to get a degree. There's practical consequences. Like, these are the feeders for these Olympic, for our Olympic teams. Like, so if you care about this stuff, this is a really big deal. I actually read through a couple of the summaries on this bill. I think it's a great first step. I hope that there's some continued bipartisan support. I mean, it gets into, yes, it addresses NIL. It even has regulations relating to agent representation of these athletes. And actually protections for the non-revenue generating sports, which I think is a really good thing.
Okay, so I want to keep going. We're going to take a break right now, but the question I want you to think about at the break is, as a small government guy, why does this issue require government intervention? Mm-hmm. So we'll talk about that with Jake Curtis. I am Kristen Bride. This is Point Taken, and we have more show left after this. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen, here with Jake Curtis for a couple more, two more segments. So we were talking about a new bipartisan bill to save college sports. So before we get into the question of why this raises to the level of needing government intervention, tell us a little bit more about what the bill does.
Yeah, so if there's kind of different categories, but ultimately it's I think establishing protections for the athletes, but also standards for the athletes. I think the summary I read said, and if I'm understanding it correctly, unless there's like an exemption relating to like a mid-season coaching transfer or something like that, I think they get one shot into the portal transfer. I think it prevents major, I don't know if it's limited just football or just major conference coaches in general, that they you know, these mid-season transfers are prohibited. Standards for agent representation of the athletes, standards relating to the ability to impact, I think, these I say lesser sports, right, but non-revenue generating sports, you know, kind of some level of protections for them. So it seems to be pretty comprehensive. I'm sure there will be tweaks. It already has had a hearing in the Senate. And in answer to your question, I think it's a fair question.
I'll reframe it rephrase it for people who just joined. So my question was, for as a small government guy, right? Even earlier today, you were talking about government not being involved in political speech and everything. And why does this raised to the level of needing government intervention? Because some people would say the NCAA is a private organization and they should figure this out on their own without government intervention. Because like, I tend to agree with you. Like, I think for a lot of other positive externalities, we got to figure out, not that I do think that there's some payment for athletes and that it was too strict before, but this also doesn't seem to be working. So like, I'm on the side of we need to do something, but it's more interesting for you and where your typical lean is that you think this does require government intervention. And so I'm just curious why you think it is.
Well, so I guess maybe one little nuance I want to add is the NCAA is a private organization, but I mean, we were talking about UW. These are not
all private institutions.
All private institutions.
Yeah,
in fact, many of them are not. And so, I mean, as from a kind of a basic, I think it's a fair question, but from a basic kind of standard, this is something that does maybe require some oversight in the sense that these are taxpayer dollars. I mean, you and I were talking about UW. You now have this weird scenario or dynamic where every year, every 2 years, like one of the biggest debates is UW funding. I think it was just this week in the news, right? Another tuition increase. Mm-hmm. So these are very much public institutions. And yet now we're in this weird dynamic where unless you, if you want to be competitive, you better have a $100 million fund to pay these athletes. So to say that this is, and I'm not suggesting this is, this was your argument, but this is not just some pure free market institution.
No,
right?
These are public entities
that may require some regulation, frankly, because, and let's be clear, right? This is all the result of some Supreme Court case law. I would argue that was a result of the NCAA being just completely unable to regulate. Like, it's like kind of, you know, it's the joke. You have one job, right? If you're the NCAA, I mean, yes, I understand they probably do other things, but ultimately, like, your job is to regulate the sports landscape on behalf of both the student athletes, but also the institutions. And it got to the point where the court was basically like, this entire arrangement is essentially illegal and you guys figure it out. Because I've heard people, you know, criticize the court decisions. It's like, well, like, it's not their job to figure out from a policy standpoint. It's like, NCAA, yes, now you need to figure this out.
Yeah.
And then, you know, kind of post-litigation, the NCAA still can't figure it out. I mean, I have a very low opinion of the NCAA at this point because essentially I honestly don't know what they do. Like, again, what do you actually do here?
What'd you say your job is
right
here?
Because it's like this. And so now if you're Congress and you have all these essentially, right, other than was it, you know, Baylor, Notre Dame right there, there are some private, you know, major programs, but for the most part, these are public programs. You know, if you're in Congress, it's like we talked about federalism. Why is this not a state issue? It's clearly like this is something that impacts the entire nation, right? It's interstate, right? So it's crossing borders. So if you're Congress, if you're, again, this bipartisan group, Cantwell, Cruz, you're looking at this saying, okay, we need to at least try to fix this so that there are, right? So we have Olympic sports so that, I mean, let's face it, if you're a female tennis player at a low Division I school, like, you're probably not getting a $100,000 NIL deal. The school is probably losing money on that program, but is there value, right? Is there value to that female tennis player getting a college degree? Heck yeah. And so I think there is a lane here for some oversight. And then maybe this is the difference between a conservative and a libertarian, right? That, I mean, I think if you have a public entity, which most of these are, and there's a significant problem, and it's federal, it's national in scope, that's exactly where there is a role for Congress.
All right. Look at us agreeing.
There you go.
There you go. All right. We're going to take one more break and then come back and wrap up today's show. All right. Jake Curtis, you survived. You survived 2 hours with me.
2 hours.
How does it feel?
This is great. Good time. Waving at people. TV.
Yeah. It's a little distracting sometimes. As an ADHD person, sometimes it's a little distracting to have four different screens.
Yes.
Up there with different commercials blasting at you and a text line open and lots of things pinging at you at any given time. But you get used to it.
I turned my cell phone off. So I'm making
progress. Turn the cell phone off. You started to remember to turn your mic on and off. So
yep.
I'll give you an A- overall for your first time as a guest co-host.
Yeah.
But yes, what else are you working on or looking at these days? We got about a minute left. We're going to have you back because Bill McCosh, who will be here Friday, but then he's gone for the next two Fridays. So we're going to have you back with Joe Zepecki.
Always a good conversation
more this month
with Joe. Yeah, he comes. He's one of these guys. He pretends like he shows up unprepared, but I see him looking at his laptop, and you know, I'm obvious. I have like my stack of Wall Street journals. Like he's just got his little MacBook, and I can see him doing some searches. So no, that's always fun. You know, at IRG, I'll just close with IRG. Like I said, we put a great report out about the legislative session, which, again, I think was a great review. I don't think we kind of wrapped up that point. There's so much that goes on in a year and a half in the legislature. It is really hard, right? For those of us even in kind of the policy world, the legal world, we get all the specialized updates. I get the WisPolitics daily, multiple daily emails. It is overwhelming. It's a great report that really summarizes a year and a half worth of activity, what we thought were the highlights, the lowlights, where the state could go. Because this is obviously an important year. We launched a new a CourtWatch website, providing a lot of resources on the courts. Again, yes, from our perspective, but I think it's very objective. And I would encourage people to check out IRGCourtWatch.org lots of resources. Educate yourself about the courts, right? It's it's a co-equal branch of government.
Absolutely. Well, I also recommend, even if you don't agree with what they say, it's good to see what they're writing. It is a very good report. Jake Curtis, as always, we'll see you in a week and a half. Yeah, week and a half. And thanks for being here with
me
today.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, news is next.